We are going, let me tell you about lessons. I don't know, did I put that on the handout? I think, yeah, I did. Future lessons. I sort of got very creative about the lessons for this month. The schedule is on your handout. Today we're going to look at a Genesis passage about the Tower of Babel. Next Sunday is out of Matthew on the difference between priceless and important. That sounds almost like an echo of last week, but I think I can make a distinction. This is stewardship time, folks. This year is exceptionally important that we respond creatively to the budget. We have some rebuilding to do. If you have not picked up, I imagine most of you have received this in the mail. Pat and I have ours in. I hope the rest of you can say that yours is too. But please, please, think carefully about what you can do to support the church this coming year. It's more important this time than I can remember for a long time. The following Sunday, on the 29th, is the day we go upstairs for breakfast and conversation in the dining room. I'll again remind you about that later, but there will not be any class in here on the 29th. Then on the 1st of October, I think we'll get back to the study guide. I haven't read it yet, but we're going to look at some material in 1 Chronicles. Sharon is not here this morning, but Sharon Tabor came up last week, and I thought she made a very interesting observation. If you weren't here last week, you won't know for sure what I'm talking about, but most of you were. We studied a passage that C.S. Lewis wrote about encouraging people to become a Christian, and they go into this great hall, and off to the side of this great hall are all the rooms of those Christians with differing beliefs. There's a Baptist room, there's a Catholic room, there's a Greek Orthodox room. There's a Jehovah's Witness room. So Christians go into the Great Hall, fitting the definition of what a Christian is. Then they migrate to the rooms that will feed them, develop a working plan for missions and education and all the various things that can only happen in a room. Sharon said, I think a lot of the young people today are in the Great Hall but can't find a room that suits them. And I think there's something to that. And I don't know exactly how to address that. But Lewis says, don't feel badly or feel ill towards those people in other rooms or who are still wandering around in the Great Hall. That at some point they'll be more comfortable fitting into environment. But I thought that was a very interesting observation that some people just don't want to go in and say, okay, I am a Methodist or whatever they are. And then I mentioned last week, Baptists get very creative and there's rooms off the Baptist room, Southern Baptist and Northern Baptist and two peas in a pod Baptist. And so it goes on and on and on.
The Baptist suite.
The Baptist suite of rooms. Yes.
I thought he said suite.
Okay. We're going to talk about Genesis, and I've introduced Genesis before, so I'm going to try not to overdo the book. Genesis is the compilation of about three primary writers or editor groups, and we refer to them as sources, the J source, the P source, the E source, and there may even be a little bit of the D source in there. And they are written at different times, and some grand editor took all of it and jammed it together. And the result is you can have something happen in chapter 1 and then repeated in chapter 2 that is distinctly different but tell the same story about the creation of man. There's a little bit of that in what we read today, and I'll get to that in a minute. But a lot of it breaks down really into chapters 1 through 11 are what we would call prehistory. And then from 12 to the end, you start getting some history, although some of it's very difficult to locate, but you get people like Abraham, Jacob and Esau, Joseph, with names of places that we can identify. So 1 through 11, is it history? Is it myth? Is it imagination? I don't know. Are there threads of history that have been massaged to create a point of view? Was the flood of Noah a historical event? I've read books both ways, but it happened. No, it didn't happen. It was regional. So, but in prehistory, a lot of prehistory is what's called an etiology. It's to explain why things are like they are. Why does a woman have pain during childbirth? Well, it's because Eve succumbed to the temptation of the snake. It says right there that from now on you're going to have pain. So it explains something that we experience and said, how'd that get started? Well, it started there. Why does not a snake have arms and legs like all the other animals? Well, because God said you're cursed and you're going to stay on the ground for the rest of eternity. So etiologies are to try to explain why things are and how they got that way. Is it science? No. But it offers an explanation for what the readers of this book experienced. Chapter 10 is written from a P source, the priestly source. And I want to read to you a few of the passages that set a direction for what God intended for people to have that seem to be addressed more completely in chapter 11. If you go all the way back to chapter 1 of Genesis, as man is created, for example, 1:28, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Go out. Go everywhere. Spread out. Then in chapter 10, we hear the genealogy of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In verse 5 of chapter 10, from these the coastland people spread. These are the descendants of Japheth in their lands with their own language by their families in their nations. So Japheth goes to the coastlands, and that's who populates the coastlands in Genesis. Verse 20 of chapter 10, these are the descendants of Ham by their families, their languages, and their lands, and their nations. And then he lists all that. Then in chapter 10, 31, these are the descendants of Shem by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the families of Noah's sons, according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Do you get some sense of what the writer's conclusion is about the intention of man populating the earth? What's the one thing that's common all through those verses I read?
They each had different language.
Yeah, they already had different languages, which we're going to find contradicted in chapter 11, which is a P source. common thing that happened in all of those, get out of here, go everywhere, spread out. Don't stay in one spot. I want you to spread out over the whole earth. What Jesus say in Matthew, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. Spread out. But the story we get in chapter 11 says, one bunch of people said, let's build a city, build some walls, and build a tower. And God didn't like that. There is a movement in prehistory that God says, scatter out, go everywhere. Then we get to chapter 11, and Darren Derwin, I'm going to ask you again, look on your handout. Now, I've got this broken down into paragraphs that are set apart from each other. Let me talk about that. That is called chiastic. It's essentially the reversal of some thoughts. A chiasm is a repetition of similar ideas in a reverse sequence. Now, as Derwin reads this, if you notice on your handout, there's an idea in verse 1, there's an idea in verse 3, there's an idea in verse 5, and then we go back to 6 is sort of a parallel to 3, and 8 is a parallel to 1. There's a lot of this throughout the Old Testament. It's a literary tool to draw your attention to how things go one way and then reverse almost along the same line, but with a different point of view. Derwin, just read the whole thing without the headings, please.
Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as they migrated from the east, or migrated eastward, they came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord said, look, they are one people. They have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there, so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth.
Okay. Do you see those ideas? Everybody has one language. But in 10, we just read that each one of the sons have languages of their own. This is a different point of view. This is another source. And what he's leading up to is an etiology. He's wanting to explain to you something. So, in paragraph A, there's one language. Then in B, there's man's words about, let's do this. And then God appraises that, comes down, looks at it, says, I don't approve of that. Then God's words speak about what he's going to do to address what he didn't like. And then the last section sort of repeats A. Thou the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. The Lord confused their languages, and the Lord scattered them abroad all over.
Wayne, who's the Lord speaking to in 6 and 7?
I can't hear Bob.
Who is the Lord speaking to?
Well, that's the magic we of Genesis. There's different points of view.
Who's
us? Is he talking to Jesus? Is he talking to Adam and Eve? Is he talking to a council, sometimes in Psalms, there's places it sounds like there's a council of some kind. In Job, there's a mention of heavenly council. I don't know.
Lady Wisdom, maybe?
Lady Wisdom, yeah. There's all kinds of theories. Or it could be just like the Queen of England when she says, "We do not approve of that brand of tea," or whatever. Don't know who the "we" is. Don't know what it is. But it's common. It's common in Genesis. Any questions about the story of Babel?
Wayne, I don't think this is my idea. I think I heard this in a sermon one time.
Oh, my.
That the difference between chapter 10 and 11 was the fact that that's what they spoke when they were at home.
Oh.
That as a group of people, they had to have some way of common interaction, talking to each other, you know, so they know what the actual price of a tomato is.
Okay.
So they developed a business language or a universal language in order to get along together.
Yeah.
Much like English is today. That's if you're flying an airplane and you speak only Urdu, and you don't know how to land that airplane.
Okay.
Because you've got to talk to a tower.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's a theory. Any questions about the story? Tim?
Wait, just another thought here. And I know you're going another direction with the lesson, which is great. But this story, in some respects, is negative towards cities.
Absolutely.
Cities are not good places.
Right.
And so Sodom and Gomorrah, not a good place. And the Bible, in these early stories, is really focused on nomadic people.
Yes, thank you.
Cities, not good places. So
I got that written down.
It's right here, yeah.
Yeah.
And they still aren't much.
They're sure popular, though.
Big group. People get into mischief.
What is the basic etiology in this story? You ought to get this. Forget chapter 10. What's the basic etiology of this story? What does this story explain?
Why there's so many languages.
Exactly. This is an etiology story about why there are different languages. Forgetting that in chapter 10 they already had different languages. That's the basic etiology. There is a little bit of anti-pagan, anti-foreigner tone to this. And that touches on what Tim was saying. Shinar is probably up in Iraq, Iran, somewhere in that area. No hills to speak of. Flat land, no mountains. And the writer describes that those folks who went up that way wanted to, first of all, build a city, and then build a tower. And what's the reason for that? What's the reason that they wanted to do this?
It says they want to show how important they are.
Yes.
I've heard it was to be closer to God.
That's one of the theories.
This doesn't say that.
Yeah.
It says we want people to recognize how great we are.
Pride is a problem in this lesson. Pride is a problem. But like Ron says, there's some theories that they had attempted to reach into heaven itself. Chances are, you know what a ziggurat is. That's not what you smoke, it's what you build. Built sort of like that in terraced layers with a ramp around the outside. Probably most of the ziggurats that were built during this time were worship centers. They were trying to make a place that would be attractive enough for their God to reside on top and have a much easier way to get down to his people, and his people could come up to him. So it was a way to try to get closer to the God that they worshiped, whoever that would be. Our God didn't approve of that. And interestingly, even in spite of what they were trying to build, notice that, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. He's way past the tower. There is no way they're going to get to where he is. So he comes down and he says, I don't like this. And he confuses their language, and they stopped building the tower. They only got part of it up. And essentially, they appear to abandon the city. They're spread out. They're going out to other places.
Wayne, at the end of verse 4, it says, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.
Yeah, they didn't want to be
they
scattered.
Didn't want to be, and God had wanted them to scatter.
Yeah, that's the contradiction that we see here. We've got a people who say, no, let's build a city and build some walls, and then we can control who comes in and goes out, and sooner or later, all the people inside the walls are going to think alike and be alike, and we won't be confused with other people's ideas. So walls, let's build some walls and separate us from others. And in the same time, we'll make it easier for God to get to us.
Do you think maybe the first 9 verses are actually an afterthought and should have put someplace else? Mm-hmm. Because verse 10 picks up exactly following verse 32.
I don't know, Sharon. I don't know.
Can't go back in time.
Yeah. I'm sure this is written much, much later than the event that
it's interesting that wealth and power are still associated with building height. Okay. The people who are the most like gods are the ones who have the penthouses on the top of the floors.
And what technology allowed them to build this super high tower?
Discovering bricks.
Learning, they knew how to pack clay and bake it in the sun, but if they heated it in an oven, it became so hard that you could put tremendous weights and build higher towers than that sun-baked stuff. So the technology that they had discovered allowed them to take an advance and build better towers, better walls than anybody else could. And there's a tone of condemnation about that technology in what the writer gives us.
But the rocks were way down deep under all that alluvial soil from Tigris and Euphrates.
Yeah. Somehow they got a good foundation.
Yeah, they got to have some other rock. Well, have rock.
Well, that gets into ziggurats, and I don't want to go too far into that. But essentially, this lesson has to do with when we discover a new technology, when there is a change presented to us, how do we evaluate whether that's good or bad? In this instance, this new technology allowed them to do something that they felt was appropriate, and God did not approve of it. But they had the technology. Think of the technologies that have been developed in our lifetime. How do we judge whether they're good or bad?
We don't have time because there's so many of them.
There's so many of them. We can't keep up. We can't keep up. Now, before I promised last week I was going to do less talking, and I'm already talking a lot, but in a minute I'm going to get very quiet and I'm going to ask you to do some things. There's an incident in the book of Acts where the reverse seems to happen to what happened in the Tower of Babel. If you will look at Acts 2:1-11, I'm going to read just a portion of that writing. I'm going to read verses 7, 8, and a little bit of 11. If you remember the incident at Pentecost, there's the rushing of winds, there's flames that land on the heads of the disciples. There is tremendous joy, and the Spirit has arrived, and it goes into Peter and the disciples, and they start talking. And the people around them are in Jerusalem because of Pentecost, and they are from all over the world. And Luke quotes them saying, utterly amazed, they ask, aren't all of these who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hear them in our native language? We hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. It's sort of the reverse of what happened at Babel. But it's not that we came back to one language. The Spirit speaks, and they're able to understand that in their native language. So it's a reversal of Babel, but it lets them retain their individuality, their diversity. They're still a diverse group of people, but they can understand what the Spirit wants them to do. That's very important.
I've always wondered, or I guess, I don't know where it came from, but the idea that that's where all the stories that are built around telepathy came from. I don't know if that means anything or what, but I realized somewhere I put those two together and said, that's the basis for it. Because if your thoughts are carried from one to another, language doesn't get in the way.
Yeah.
And I don't know anywhere else that somebody would have come up with that idea except in those verses in the Bible.
Could be. Folks, what we read something we don't understand in the Bible, we do the very best we can to try to explain it. And at some point, you've got to say, I don't understand that. I never will understand it. Now, do I believe it or not?
But doesn't it verify that the Bible worked? That there was a need for different languages? That's why the tongues are speaking in different languages as a result of what happened in our Bible.
But you raised a point. Did we need different languages? I don't.
Well, God seemed to think so. Because he's...
Yeah, but he was doing that to prevent them from doing something he didn't want them to do.
Right. And so it shows it worked because they were still different languages. He bring them back together again.
Yeah.
So the need for different tongues shows that apparently that worked.
There's also a piece of that that's all kind of contradictory.
Well,
like you said, it's a story trying to explain how something happened. But we also know that if groups of people are separated with no contact over hundreds of years, their languages evolve until they can't talk to each other. So
we speak
that
English
happens over a great length of time naturally.
Yeah, we speak English, but we couldn't understand them speaking English in the 15th century. If somebody walked up and spoke English, we couldn't understand it, but it's English. So anyway, this is the point I want you to take over. I've done my best to set two stories in front of you, and they deal with Babel and then what happens at Pentecost. Let's assume for a minute now that you're the teacher of the class. What are we to learn from these stories? I promise you, I'll be real quiet. What are we to get out of this?
Don't let your self-worth get ahead of you.
Don't let what?
Your self-worth.
Okay.
Become
right.
Too important.
Yeah. That's got to be part of it.
And in different. Go ahead.
Jim, I think you were first.
I was going to say there's a debate among scholars in this text in Acts. Was the miracle of Pentecost one of speaking, or was it one of hearing?
Okay.
And it's very clear. And of course, I'm going to go with the hearing side. It's very clear in this text, each one heard in his own language. Our Pentecostal friends have misunderstood that in thinking that it's some kind of a heavenly tongue that was spoken. They were all speaking Galilean, could have been Galilean Greek for all that matter.
Yeah.
Galileans tend to be Greek.
Right.
But everyone heard in their own language.
Okay.
So one of the takeaways that I've wrestle with for years is that when God's people are not hearing the Spirit's movement in our diversity, we embrace our diversity, we're not all going to agree on it. Kathy and I don't agree on everything. But I'm not dumping her because we disagree on some things. So we're not going to agree on everything, but can we hear the Spirit making us a community a collegial community of faith.
You sure you didn't read my lesson?
I didn't.
You're on target.
But are we hearing? Are we hearing the Spirit make of us the people of God in all of the wonderful diversity that we are?
That I approve. Margie, you started.
Well, I was going to say that at different times, different things are needed, like God needed people to scatter all over the earth, and then in Pentecost, God needed people to hear the same thing. And because technology has changed so much over the years, now we have translators, and so you can be speaking in one language, but, you know, like at international meetings, you have technology to translate for you into your language.
Pat and I had an interesting conversation with a clerk in a store in Cartagena. We were looking at some of her merchandise, and she could hear us speak, and then she pushed something on her button, and she answered in our language.
She couldn't say it to us to read.
Yeah, she just held it up around the screen. So technology's changed. The issue is, and I think Margie's got an interesting point here, at this point in history, God seemed determined for them to scatter. We probably aren't addressing the same issues today. But was it important for God to help people retain their diversity? Was that part of the plan? I don't want all my followers to believe and think and do the same thing. I want you to retain your individual diversity, but come together for good things that you can do in unity, but not
but don't think you're as good as I am.
Okay, yeah, don't try to. The church is a diverse group who comes together in unity to do work that God addresses for us. He does not want us to seek uniformity to where we all believe and think the same thing. Now, that's real important to my point in this lesson. There are times, but no, I'm teaching again. I want to hear more from you. I'm just dabbling a few bits of bait in front of you. What are we to get out of this Bible story?
Well, it's sort of like a sports team where you need defensive and offensive. You need linemen. You need different.
You don't
let come together.
Yeah, you don't let the center be quarterback very often.
Yeah.
Okay, good point.
But the church the same way. By having people who are interested in music, having people interested in missions, I always said we have a WMU lady in our church, and she promoted all the offerings.
All right.
And so with everybody making contributions from their point of view of what's important, then I think that makes the church stronger.
It's very important. It's very important. I think you're getting the direction of this that I'm trying to go. Think of this in terms of church now. I think this is a lesson that teaches us when something comes along, when a new technology or a new change comes along, why would we be drawn to a change? How do we evaluate whether a change is good or bad? I came up with three things that would encourage us to adapt a new idea. Is it more useful or more economical? Will it save me something if I adapt this? Unfortunately, I think there's a whole lot of it that we're motivated because Bill and Eddie have it. Well, maybe I ought to have it too. We want to catch up with whatever the new breakthrough is.
I'll give it to you. My knee hurts.
I can have that one. And gradually, when we adapt to change or adapt to technology, what we're doing is becoming more like-minded, and we lose a little bit of our diversity. And I think that's a bad thing. when a change comes along, one of the tests we should give is who benefits from that change? Did anybody benefit from building a city and a tower? Except the contractors.
Well, the business people do, because they're, it brings business people closer together so they can interact at the higher levels, working together to accomplish things.
Yeah.
For my business, I need certain resources that I'm not going to provide myself, and if the guy who provides them is just a block down the street, it's a lot easier than if he's 50 miles or 100 miles or 1,000 miles away. At least in the old economy.
All right.
Moving now, that's less important.
One of the tests then is, what can I get out of this? How's this going to benefit me? Is that what God would want me to think? No. I think God would say, no, Wayne, I want you to get into this because it is useful for what I want my people to do and be, not what I get out of it selfishly. I mentioned earlier about some of you said, the ego. We're told in Genesis that the reason to do it was that we want to be, have the, come let us build it together, a tower, and let us make a name for ourselves. We want the prestige that this magnificent new Disney World feature is going to attract. It's going to make us look more important and make us look better. So when a change comes along, I think one of the things we need to evaluate is who does this benefit? Second thing that I think is very important about change is, does it build a wall or a bridge? The concern to me in this was that if they build a city and it's walled like cities were, what that identifies is we're inside and those people on the outside aren't quite like us, and that's a good thing. And God says, no, no, I don't want walls, I want bridges. I want you to go out to all the world and tell them what I have done for you and what you're to do. Does the change promote uniformity or unity? Does it draw diverse people together to accomplish something that benefits God's plan? Or does it make us more alike? Who gains from this technology? Pat and I talked about this a couple of days ago, and we know a lot of small churches that are getting smaller because they have decided that the walls of their church are as far as they want to go. Pat grew up in a church that had closed communion. If you're a stranger, it doesn't matter if you're a Baptist or not, if you're not a member here, you can't share communion. Walls tend to make people believe uniformity. That's exactly what happened in the 70s to the Southern Baptist Convention. They were not going to be willing to let new ideas slip in that contradicted what they knew the infallible Bible said. And CBF and others said, no, the Spirit is speaking to us about going out into the world and using new ideas with everybody, that God loves everybody. I put up a cartoon over there that I got from Clark Pennell this week. You might glance at it. Jesus is preaching and says, love everybody no matter what. And somebody in the crowd speaks up and says, what if they have tattoos? And Jesus says, yes, even if they ask stupid questions. So pride gets in the way. Build bridges, not walls. Is there any reason to have a church? Why don't we just all go out and do whatever we feel like God's calling us to do? Why invest in a building and pay the light bill and all that kind of stuff?
Well, you can do more. You're stronger together.
to go out and do more.
There are times that unity of believers is very important. How else are you going to pass along to generations if you don't have some kind of unified system of education, organized for missions? The church can do a whole lot more than I can individually. If I walk downtown and say, I'm going to be a missionary to Asheville, wouldn't get very far. So, churches that build and respect walls will die eventually. The church itself becomes a palace, a castle, a cathedral, diamonds and rubies on the walls. Everything's invested inside instead of outside. There's no mission, no outreach. There's brands of Baptists that said, if God wants the Africans to believe in me, he'll talk to them. I don't have to. So there is reasons for a church to have unity at times. Then there's a whole lot of times when it's supposed to be scattered. It's supposed to use that unity to prepare, train, and educate, and then you're supposed to get out there and do it. We need to have a balance between unity and scattering. A church that's functioning well is going to have unity with diversity. We don't all have to think the same thing. We don't all have to believe the same thing. We don't have to believe every verse in the Bible the same way. But we have unity so that we can band together to get out there and do the things that God's calling us to do. I don't want to be a church member of a church that everybody believes the same thing. I think it would be so boring. We don't all like the same kind of music. Some people don't like Sunday school, some people do. It would be so boring if we were all alike. So we need unity with diverse people, but there's got to be a strong emphasis to tear down the wall and build a bridge out there to where everybody else is. Oh, I taught again. I promised I wouldn't teach.
Back to the wall around the Babel city.
Okay.
As they were building that wall, they determined where it was going to be.
Okay.
So in building the wall, they were intentionally separating one group from another group.
Yep.
And that was part of their pride.
Yes.
That was their sin.
Yeah.
The tower, and the reason they wanted this closed city was so they could set prices.
Yeah. And they could limit access to the tower if they had a wall. Yeah. Good point.
Right. And there was, it was like a small farmer up against Archer Daniels Midland.
Okay.
ConAgro.
Yeah.
There's a problem with that's it's not basic human nature to be looking for security.
Absolutely.
And the best way, one of the things that makes you feel safe is being around other people who you think will support you.
Yeah, you're right.
And to the extent that that's a very strong pull to get people to say, okay, we're here and you're over there and you're different, you're a problem.
Yeah.
And why it just seems to be a natural human tendency.
Yeah.
I experience it. People tell me I'm crazy. I ride the same bike route almost every time. And I say the reason I'm basically doing it for exercise, and I don't want to have to think at each corner which way I'm going to go. I just know I'm almost on automatic pilot to follow this same route.
Okay.
Say, do you get bored? No, not usually, because that's not my purpose. But it's easier to go the same way than it is to make all these decisions. Where am I going to ride today? You know, and it's the same way with so many things that we do.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And we've got to balance that against the other aspect of needing the diversity, the stimulation, the whatever, the contact with groups that are different. And that's the hard part.
Yeah, yeah. Pride is a factor. I mentioned that before. But pride is a factor in this. If we discover a technology like Bill Gates did, he got wealthy. He got very wealthy. But what did he do with it? He gives huge amounts of it away. He scatters it. I don't know how much of a Christian Bill Gates is. I honestly don't have any idea if he's a believer or not, but I know that the way he was obviously a genius in technology, and he understood that he wanted to help people with what he gained from it. There's a lot of people, I don't know why I'm hung up on big houses, but I read stories or see on television about a primary residence for this guy and his wife that's 12,000 square feet. I got a problem with that. What is that for? It's for his ego, for his pride. There's something wrong if your breakthrough, your technology, and your change feeds your ego and doesn't end up using a building a bridge to something outside. Lad Painter's already heard this story, but I want to tell it to you anyway. There were two ducks and a frog that were very fond of each other in a small pond. And winter was approaching, and the water was beginning to freeze over. And they got together, and they were talking about the ducks could fly off, but the frog was stuck. So they came up with the idea that the ducks could get a long stick and hold it in their feet, and the frog could grab a hold of the middle of the stick with his mouth, and they could fly away up to somewhere in the south. So they did that. And they got up to the duck's cruising altitude, and one duck speaks to the others too and says, "This is a wonderful idea. Who thought this up?" And the frog opened his mouth and said, he fell to his death. So pride can get you into trouble. Let's go ahead and look at what I've got under here. I think it's a repeat. Somebody mentioned this right at the very beginning. Change is going to come always. Change is the only constant we've got. Change is constant. We can evaluate new changes and new technologies by sitting down honestly and talking about who benefits from this. And I think there are times for unity and times for scattering, and I want unity with diversity. We don't need to all be the same or think the same or believe the same in order to do God's work. And we need to seek a balance between unity that's inside and scattering that's on the outside. And we can't get hung up on this one, and we can't get hung up on this one. It takes a blend of both for the church to work. What did I leave out? I said it all. All right, let's stand for prayer. Father, we're human, and we don't always behave the way you think we should. And we'd prefer that you be gentle with us and forgive us when we lose sight of what you've put us here to do. Encourage us that we might be patient with others, that we understand the need for diversity, that our collective wisdom is always better than an individual thought, that we are willing to leave the safety of that unity to go into all the world and preach the gospel. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen. Well, yeah.